Good morning, Park City. You're listening to KPCW's Local News Hour. I'm your host, Jennifer Dobner, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. We're going to jump right into the weather this morning with an update from ABC4's Cedric Haynes so we can see what to expect for the week.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back as we progress throughout a new week, the first official full week of spring. Let's dive in. Here's a look at your forecast in the Park City area. Look for partly to mostly cloudy skies as we go throughout today. Again, we'll still see some peaks of sunshine, but we will have more clouds in the sky as a weak front moves by to our north. Highs will be in the mid-60s, still well above average in Park City today, with highs in the low 70s expected for us in the Heber Valley. But don't worry, the warming trend will continue over the next few days as we look at the sunshine returning. We'll call it mostly sunny skies for our Tuesday. That'll allow for those high temperatures to surge into the low 70s for us in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures warming all the way up into the upper 70s again for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Wednesday, the hump day forecast, lots of sunshine expected. Likely will be our warmest day of the week, and we'll likely be back to those record-shattering high temperatures as we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the mid-70s for us in Park City as we go throughout your Wednesday. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. So that heat dome slides back in across the area as we get towards the middle of the week. Luckily for us, we've got another weak, dry, cool front that will be making its way to the area across northern Utah as we go into your Thursday and Friday. So what that will do will bring us a few extra high clouds in the sky, but it will bring us a little bit of a cool down. Temperature still above average, but a little cooler though, as we see those highs only in the mid-60s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the low 70s again in the Heber Valley. And as we get into your Friday again, we're looking at highs only in the low 60s in Park City with highs only around 70 in the Heber Valley. Again, a few high clouds will accompany that front, but that'll be about it in terms of any major effects. We do warm it right back up, though, at least start to warm it up for the weekend with highs back into the mid to upper 60s in Park City and highs back into the mid 70s in the Heber Valley with dry conditions. That's a good latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, we'll be joined by Adam Craig. He's an immigration attorney. He's going to talk to us about the state of the immigration in Utah and the new ICE detention facility coming to Salt Lake City. Then Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff will be in with some new visitor numbers. And Best Friends Animal Society Chief of Mission Officer Holly Sizemore has all the news about National Puppy Day, pet adoption, and recent legislation that is helping shelter animals. Dozens of Wasatch Back residents learned about self-reliance and preparedness Saturday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports many were concerned about potential economic impacts this year.
Saturday at the biannual Wasatch County Self-Reliance and Preparedness Fair, Wasatch Back locals learned about everything from preparing for a community disaster to controlling weeds and keeping chickens. Longtime Heber City resident Larry Bauer attended to learn about gardening and bees.
The way the world's going, we don't know what's going to happen with calamities, and you need to be prepared.
Bauer said recent world events and the U.S. economy have driven him to think about self-reliance more. He also wants to be prepared for natural disasters that could impact the Heber Valley, including floods and earthquakes. Rebecca Wadsworth was at the event sharing information about food storage. Her Alpine food storage business helps locals store essentials for emergencies. She said the COVID-19 pandemic is a great example of when storing food comes in handy.
People were scrambling to find the things they needed, and so you just never know when something like that's going to happen.
Wadsworth said she's heard from many who are worried about the economy. She said the best way to start being prepared is to collect food a little at a time.
Price is going up all the time, and the fluctuation there, like, grab things while they are on a sale. Start with what you already use. Like, if you go to the store to get 2 cans of corn, get 4 cans of corn, and you have a little bit of extra in case you need something.
Russ Olson, who teaches weekly self-reliance classes as part of the Heber Valley Self-Reliance Group, agreed it's good to start small. He said canned goods are a good start, but growing food can be a healthier option. He recommends locals begin by growing microgreens in their homes, then move to a small garden in the summer. Olson said freeze-drying food is also a more nutritious choice when compared to canning food. That's because bottled goods are heated to high temperatures first, which decreases the nutritional value.
The nutritional value of freeze-dried food is like 100 times better and lasts up to 25, 30 years.
Really?
Whereas if you're canning or bottling it, it only lasts 5 years.
Freeze dryers can be expensive, so Olson recommends families and friends buy one together and share it. He said self-reliance is important for a wide variety of reasons.
We can always think of the major disasters that could happen in a community, but how about if you have a personal tragedy in your family, lose a job, and you're out of work for some time?
All in all, Olson said many things go into self-reliance, including food storage or gardens, financial security, communication systems, and more. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Immigration has been a front and center issue across the country since the Trump administration established mass deportation policies. But what does that look like in Utah and the Wasatch Back? Joining us now by phone is immigration attorney Adam Craik, who's been working on the front lines. Good morning, Adam. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. And yourself?
Oh, a little worried because I just had to run out of the immigration courthouse to get on this call.
Oh, well,
so I'm glad I made it.
We appreciate that you're with us. Can you just quickly,
yep,
for our listeners, tell us a little bit about you, how long you've been working in immigration law?
Sure. Let's see. I was a clerk for Judge Benson. He was the chief federal judge from 03 to 05. So then 05 till now.
Mm-hmm.
So 21 years doing immigration law.
So
I think it's funny. We own the largest immigration and criminal defense, private immigration and criminal defense firm in our state and basically mostly in the West.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no end to the work, I'm sure. Can you tell me how the system is different now than it was pre-2021? Like
it's unrecognizable.
Changed? Yeah. And why?
In every facet. So here's the thing is people think that there's new immigration laws, and there is one, the new Lake and Riley bill that was passed last year. That pertains to immigration as a congressional passed law. But as far as immigration law goes, the most comprehensive immigration law reform we have, and the law that we're relying on right now, is from 1996. That was passed by President Clinton, at that time, and was implemented on April 1st, 1997. So really what you're seeing is different styles of enforcement. And right now, style of enforcement is unprecedented. I've never seen this type of enforcement in my life.
And tell me what you mean by that. I mean, I think we read in news stories about people being picked up when they're going to the normal immigration processes at court. In some cases, people's homes are being broken into, or they've been taken from their jobs or off the street. What's happening here in Utah?
So I think some of the things that, and we're kind of shielded, we're a little bit lucky here in Utah. We don't get we get some fairly dramatic things, but we don't get some of the actions that you see in Minnesota, some of the stuff that you see in other places. But what we have here is basically arrests, targeted arrests, but also people that get swept up in other people's arrests. You get a lot of activity that relates to people that don't have any criminal history, people that don't have, and effectively no criminal history, that are still getting picked up because there's an extreme amount of pressure to arrest on a daily basis a lot of people, and then use those people as to fill quotas and to make sure that they're complying. And when I mean they, I'm talking about our ICE agents, to comply with the average that they're supposed to arrest on a daily basis.
And do we know what the scope of that is? Like how many arrests we've seen in Utah, how many deportations?
I haven't kept track of those numbers exactly, but I can tell you that right now, oh boy, I'm personally handling, I can't even, it's in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And then right now in the state of Utah, that just non-detained, so people that are not in immigration custody, we have 48,000 pending immigration deportation cases.
48,000?
48,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And those are people that are not detained. Those are people that are just in deportation proceedings.
And I mean, ICE always picked people up here. Like there was an agreement with jails. Like,
yeah.
If you have somebody who's accused of a crime and they are an undocumented person, that cooperation was already existing. But that seems to be ramping up now.
It does in certain areas. And honestly, these 287G agreements, they're more Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, those are the contracts that sheriff's offices make with ICE.
To... Yep.
And you said they're more...
And honestly, they're more for show. I most of the jails were already assisting ICE in their efforts because, I mean, if you look at it, there are places where you have to kind of pick and choose your battles. And jail, synonymously, is a place where people have been arrested and been charged, right?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that they're not innocent, that we always believe in innocent until proven guilty. I get that. But a lot of voters, whether you agree with it or not, chose to have ICE and immigration in the forefront. And on public perception, the public perception battle, one of the hardest places for us to win as immigration attorneys and those that are advocates for immigration is the jail.
Mm.
So if I'm being brutally candid, I'm okay with the jail agreements because, again, in the public perception battle, I don't win a whole lot trying to convince people that I shouldn't be arresting people who have fairly significant charges.
Sure, that has been the normal process.
Especially if they're, and that is the normal process. And you know what? That's a process that we've dealt with for years. And if we, but here's what's crazy is we used to prevail, or we could choose or figure out a way we would resolve the criminal case. They would go into ICE custody and then they would be eligible to apply for a bond. Well, this administration in September of 2025 came out. And when I mean this administration, I'm talking about the Board of Immigration Appeals. They came out with a case called Matter of Yajure Hurtado, which basically says that all people who came across the border at any time, whether they've been here for 30 years, 40 years, 5 years, 1 year, they're not eligible to get out of immigration custody. They are not bondable. Okay? Which then has sparked the most amazing proliferation of habeas corpus petitions that this country's seen in maybe ever. I've never seen the amount of habeas corpus petitions that have been filed across this nation like we have in 25 and 20 and the start of 26.
Can you tell people what that means, a habeas corpus petition?
Yeah. So what it means is essentially we essentially sue the government, right? So we sue formerly Kristi Noem, Pam Bondi, the Executive Office of Immigration Review, which is the immigration court, and then the warden of the facility where the person's being detained.
Mm-hmm.
And we say that they've been their constitutional rights have been violated because they're being held without due process of law.
And due process is provided to everyone under the 14th Amendment, regardless of status. Is that correct?
Well, not only that, because it's the federal government doing it, they are entitled to 4th Amendment, 5th Amendment, right? So this is actually federal intervention. We don't need the 14th on this. We have direct 4th and 5th Amendment rights. So we're suing them. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that seems like just adding more complications to the legal process.
Well, I can't even explain to you how much money our federal government is. Because here's the great thing. Back in the day or back before 2025, a habeas corpus petition is kind of a Hail Mary, right? It's your last resort.
Mm-hmm.
I think our percentage of wins now on these Hail Mary types of petitions, which are no longer Hail Marys, I think we're around 97% wins across the nation. We're not just talking Utah. We're not just talking, liberal states. We're talking across the United States, meaning we're not losing these. Meaning federal judges are finding that this case, this Yajure Hurtado, is a constitutional violation in and of itself.
So do we know...
Just last week...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go.
Well, no, just last week, Judge David Barlow granted a habeas corpus petition, and this one's really sad. We have two Afghanistan brothers whose father fought for 25 years with American soldiers, Australian soldiers, NATO forces. I mean, he's got page after page of medals and awards. And they showed up for an appointment with their alternatives to detention officer. And instead of doing a follow-up appointment, which the notice said, they were taken into custody and arrested. And we just won that case here in Utah saying, no, you can't do that. You cannot do this.
Do we know if the number of ICE or Customs and Border Patrol agents have increased in Utah in recent months?
Oh, yeah. So Good news is Border Patrol agents have now left our city, left our state. They were here for a while, but all of our, well, the vast majority of our ICE agents went to Minnesota. So a lot of our ICE agents were involved in that as well. They've now all returned to Utah, and there is, there are quite a few additional ICE agents, but we are lucky enough to have the Border Patrol agents. They're gone, and man, they were creating some disaster situations.
So let's talk for a minute about this proposal, or I guess the in what seems like an inevitability of maybe the largest detention center facility in the country being here in Utah. The warehouse was purchased a couple of weeks ago. We've been seeing there are protests there. The state governor says, you know, we need it. What does it say about us as a state if we're going to house more people than anyone else in the country?
Oh, it's embarrassing, candidly. And let me explain the context there. This is 7,500 people. And what is really more frustrating is if you really do the research here and do the background on this, 70% of the people incarcerated currently in ICE custody do not have criminal history. So this policy shift from alternatives to detention, right? So ankle monitoring, check-ins, monitoring by ICE agents has essentially gone away. And the model has shifted to, we're just going to detain you. Now, when you look at 7,500 beds and we already have 48,000 people in removal proceedings, there are two judges who are actively working right now in Utah. And there's an additional hire that just started that really is not educated and doesn't understand how the process works yet. So the two judges right now can barely handle their caseloads. I just got a merits hearing or an individual trial hearing set. They've now eclipsed all of 2029. So they're not even able to offer us a date anymore because their calendars have moved into 2030. So if somebody wants to have a final trial in Utah, they're offering dates in 2030.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, take that, magnify it by an additional 7,500 beds. Presumably, they're going to have to ramp up because what's so what's so interesting is there are 23 immigration prosecutors in Utah.
So that creates a huge imbalance.
They got the money from...
Go ahead.
Oh, it's an enormous imbalance. It's nonsensical. It's illogical, nonsensical, but I don't think we've ever accused this current administration of logic. So anyway, there's 23 prosecutors, two judges, and it's just so frustrating. Even the judges, you know, they're like, well, I can offer you a date in 2030. And people who have been waiting for a while to present their cases, they don't get to present their cases.
So presumably this detention facility would be like some in other states where it would be like a regional hub and they would bring people from everywhere. But the pace seems like it would quickly, you know, surpass the capacity if it's 7,500.
Oh, absolutely. And what's so frustrating, too, is with two judges and potentially a ramp up, all this really does is convinces people that our system doesn't work and that it basically causes them to give up, and they end up just signing a removal order and they just give up and they go back to the persecution and the horrific conditions that they had fled for, that they had fled from.
So what are you going to be watching for? They've purchased the facility, but I know the mayor of Salt Lake City has said she's going to fight it with everything she's got. So what are you watching for right now?
Well, what's so frustrating is Governor Cox announcing that we do need an ICE facility. And don't get mad at me. There is a little bit of truth to that. There is. Because it is really hard when your clients get arrested to try and communicate with them in California, Nevada, Colorado. The problem is the magnitude and scale of this facility and the conditions, right? What I'm going to be looking for is there are ways to sue the government. I don't know if you can stop them from building, but there are ways to effectively sue them for violating rights, because this is what people need to understand is this is a civil detention.
Mm-hmm.
People in ICE custody, it's not a criminal detention. So the civil detention requires a higher standard of care,
mm-hmm.
a higher, like higher temperatures in the dishwasher. It's, you can't really detain them as you do with criminals. But that seems to be what's perpetually being ignored.
Okay. Well, we're about out of time. Adam, I want to really thank you for stepping away from court to speak with us. We'll be checking back, I'm sure, as this all of this continues to move forward. Thanks a lot.
I'm happy to do it.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Construction resumes in April on bus rapid transit lanes in Park City and Snyderville Basin. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has what High Valley Transit says drivers can expect.
Greater Park City is in the midst of a multi-year effort to widen State Route 224 and make room for dedicated bus lanes. The Bus Rapid Transit Project is meant to help buses bypass traffic and make public transportation a more convenient option. High Valley Transit Executive Director Caroline Rodriguez says her team is ready and waiting to start construction this summer.
The design is complete, ready for construction and permits in hand. And construction is full steam ahead on Monday, April 6th.
Thursday, she showed the Park City Council finalized designs for the bus lanes, plus new high visibility crosswalks and added turn lanes at what's known as the Box of Rocks intersection of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive.
This design will move cars more efficiently through the intersection, reducing backups on 224 and Deer Valley Drive, enhancing pedestrian safety.
In fall 2025, construction teams removed medians and restriped lanes. Rodriguez says the narrower lanes also encourage drivers to slow down on 224. Kate LaChapelle, the construction manager from Stacy Whitbeck, says the most disruptive work will be done at night. Crews will also avoid construction during holidays, the ski season, and major community events.
This includes like the Running with Ed event. We've looked at that route to not be impacted by construction and also looking at Arts Festival, 4th of July, and all of those events.
Trail users may need to take detours during portions of the construction. Locals will receive information in the mail about what to expect during the 2026 construction season from April through November. Residents can also sign up for email or text updates on High Valley Transit's website. To see the latest renderings of the future bus lanes, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
With me now in studio is Jennifer Wesselhoff, President and CEO of the Park City Chamber of Commerce. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
So you're back with us for your monthly update on all things tourism and business in the area. Let's start with the most recent lodging data. What are we seeing?
It's no secret that this has been a very challenging season for all of our businesses and resorts here in Park City. I do have lodging data for February. February occupancy was down about 12%. Rates were up just a little bit. So we are seeing some leveling off of rates. And generally speaking, month over month this season, occupancy, so overnight visitation at our hotels have been down month over month, including looking forward as well.
And do you have January numbers as well?
I do. January was down about 6% in terms of occupancy, February down double digits, and also looking forward at March, occupancy right now is looking down with reservations on the books about 15%.
So let me take a slight detour and ask you about January, because I think there's a Sundance factor there that most people think means more heads in beds. Is that what they say?
And, it's better than butts in beds, I guess.
Okay, well, I guess, yeah. But it doesn't seem to translate quite that smoothly.
You know, I think it showed up a little bit in our tax collections. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're seeing some leveling off of overnight visitation, we are seeing really good spending still, which overall I think is a really good marker of the industry overall. I do have tax collections from the county through February. Now remember, these are always 2 months late, so this represents December performance. So I don't quite have the January Sundance impact yet, and I won't have those for a few more months. But looking at the most recent local sales taxes for December performance, taxes were up about 2%. Restaurants were up just a little bit, a half of a percent. But we are seeing, like I said, those transient room taxes, those overnight visitors, declining with TRT down about 14%. And the first time in a long time, the recreation, arts, and parks tax collections down about 5%.
But if you're looking at like 6 months back, we're kind of close to even?
You know, and I think that's the way we have to look at it right now. We're seeing so many variations with when businesses are paying their taxes. So using the actual month that they pay their taxes isn't necessarily representing the performance anymore. Some are paying, for example, when you book a room, some hotels are paying a portion of that tax in the booking month and then paying the remainder when the stay is completed. So really looking at it more on a seasonal basis, I think, is the direction that we need to be going. And when you look at the last 6 months, occupancy for the last 6 months was down just about 4%. And those average daily rates that visitors pay on those lodging rooms was down about 2%. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we are just starting to see some normalization of the occupancy, of visitation, of spending, of rates, really just starting to level off. Since I've been here about 5 years, we've been seeing this COVID impact and these COVID increases, double-digit year-over-year growth, and we're just starting to see some stabilization mm-hmm. of those numbers now.
This can't be the first year that it was late snow or low snow. So does history tell us anything about what to expect in the future?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that, and I want to be hesitant to say that because we had a low snow this year that we're going to continue to have low snow, because we don't want one season to dictate the future. Because if we did, 2 years ago, we had record snow, 700 right. inches, right? But I do think we want to take it as a canary in the coal mine of what are we learning from this? How can we improve the visitor experience? Especially, you know, most of our businesses tell us that they generate 60 to 70% of all of their revenue for the year during the winter season, during the ski season. So what does that mean if season starts later? What does that mean if we get less visitors during that Christmas week? And what can we be thinking about as a business community, as leaders, to start diversifying the amenities and the experiences that people get to experience when they're here mm-hmm. in Park City? So we're giving that a lot of thought to make sure that we're really ensuring a robust visitor economy all year round, really.
Well, that has been the movement towards a year-round place for destination for people to come. But along those lines, a little bit jump back to Sundance. At the recent leadership symposium, the arts panel was talking a lot about the need for more resources and investment in arts and, you know, to expand beyond the ski town. So are there any efforts underway or ideas for filling that Sundance void?
Yes, I would say there's a lot of folks working in the community at different levels thinking about, we don't want to say fill the Sundance void because I don't think there's anything that's going to ever fill that social, cultural, economic impact that an event that we had for over 40 years developed for us. But I think we do want to think about what does that product, what do the amenities, what do the visitor, what does the experience, not just for visitors, but locals too, look like year round? And I'm not sure if today we would have picked to have a film festival in the middle of our ski season. So looking at how do we lean into our winter? How do we lean into our Olympic legacy, our outdoor recreation, and our arts and culture and our heritage? And what does that look like in the future year round? And then we're giving that a lot of thought.
When you look ahead at the next 6 months, what are those projections like? And I guess one question would be, is it really too early to tell?
I mean, the booking windows are definitely shorter these days than they've ever been for visitation. We are gearing up for our summer campaign, and that will start in the next month or so, believe it or not. Right now, when we look at reservations on the books, our pace is slow. Looking at the next 6 months, we're off about 9%. And those average daily rates are down about 2%. So again, some leveling off of those rates. You know, I think that there's a lot of competition out there for that summer traveler, especially with our national parks and also having limitations with our international market as well, mm-hmm. with what's going on in the world. I think we can expect to see some continual leveling off of visitation.
I wonder if people aren't just making plans a little bit later than they normally would because the economy's been a little up and down and the world's a little up and down.
And fuel prices, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably going to impact the number of flights that are coming in, you know, the volume of visitors coming in, and also even car trips. Driving trips mm-hmm. with the cost of fuel. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see that nationwide, see mm-hmm. some impacts to that.
So you touched on taxes. I did want to ask you about the legislative session and some of the tax impacts that they were talking about. How did those shake out in the end?
You know, there were a couple of, there were over 1,000 bills that were introduced this legislative session. We were paying attention to about 100 of them throughout the session. There were two in particular that were really important to us. First was the restaurant tax repeal. There was a chance that a bill would have passed to repeal the full restaurant tax, which for the state is about a $90 million economic impact. For us here in Summit County, we generate about $5 million in that restaurant tax, which helps fund a lot of our nonprofits, a lot of our great events that take mm-hmm. place in town. So it was really important to us that we kept that restaurant tax, and that was a big win for us. There were no changes in that restaurant tax collections or repeal of that. So we're really pleased to watch that one. And then the second one that we paid a lot of attention to was HB 59, and this is identification verification in the alcohol omnibus bill. So I don't know if many people recognized that in, you know, the last 6 months, anytime you wanted a drink, an alcoholic beverage in a restaurant, you had to actually show your ID no matter what your age. So even if you were, you know, 60, 70 years old and you wanted a glass of wine at dinner, you were gonna you had to show your ID and get your ID scanned. So we were able to make some changes in mm-hmm. that bill, which if you look under 35, then you still need to show your ID, but anyone over 35 doesn't necessarily have to show their ID at a restaurant anymore, which is a big win.
I'm a little past 35, and I don't really mind. You did also mention the Olympics, and I wanted to know, you were on the delegation that went to Milan Cortina. What did you see that you were really impressed with? What tips and tricks are you bringing back?
Oh, there were so many things. There are about 100 of us in the Utah delegation over the course of the games. And for me, I was really interested in seeing how the communities activated and what that experience was on the streets, how the businesses were engaged, what those community celebrations looked like. And in Milan and Cortina, those celebrations were, I would say, contained in very specific areas and in fan zones and spectator zones, which I foresee in our community in 34, there'll be a lot more energy on the streets and activations and our businesses. And you know, I really hope that our businesses get engaged and that we give them the tools and the resources that they need to be able to create incredible celebrations. One of the interesting data points that I learned in Milan about the Paris Games was that the same number of people who attended an event, a ticketed event, the same number of people actually attended a free community celebration or fan area. And I thought that was really cool and something that we definitely want to do here in Summit County as we're thinking about how do we engage our youth, how do we engage our businesses and our residents and make our residents feel more like hosts rather than spectators and really making those games feel connected to our community.
Was there a similarity from over here in the U.S., it seemed like some of those communities are pretty small. They may have some of the same like transportation, moving people around challenges that we have sometimes here. So are these fan zones or these event areas, is it designed to keep things moving but at the same time give you a place to celebrate the Olympics?
I think it's both. The big difference between the 34 games and what we experienced in Italy was just the sheer geographic nature of the games. You know, here in Utah, all of the venues will be within 1 hour drive of each other. And in Italy, there were some venues that were 6 hours by bus, changing buses. And it really made us realize that transportation is an incredibly emotional experience that impacts your entire experience. But one of the other key takeaways and one of the best moments of my experience there was in Anholtz, where we had the chance to visit and see the women's biathlon sprint. And it was such a well-executed event, and you could tell that they were practiced. They held a world championship biathlon event there every year, and everything was just executed exceptionally, from the visitor entrance to parking, and there was a media center. The hospitality was so well done, and it just reminded me how important practice is and test events will be for us as we prepare for 34. Mm-hmm. We're going to need to practice not just our venues and their teams and their staffs, but volunteers and transit and transportation and security and volunteers, visitors, where they go, where they park. And that's going to be, I think, a really fun part of building up to 34.
Well, we do have some of that practice already under our belt, so I expect we'll be seeing a lot more.
We do.
We're about out of time, but I do know that the Chamber's business survey is about to wrap up. Is there still time for folks to take it?
That deadline has passed, so we are going to go ahead and start gathering those results, and that will ultimately lead into our planning for the upcoming year. But we do have a save the date for the Wasatch Back Economic Summit. That's a regional event that we partner with the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce as well. That'll be held on May 11th at the Grand Hyatt. That event will most likely sell out, so if listeners are interested in attending, just visit parkcitychamber.com and hit on events. We would love to have you join us. It's just such a great opportunity to talk about regional issues that impact our entire community.
We'll start that Olympic conversation.
Exactly. We are having a lunch keynote from Learnings on the Games.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Jennifer Wesselhoff from the Park City Chamber. Thanks so much for dropping in.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Have a great day. Now we're joined by Best Friends Animal Society Chief Mission Officer Holly Sizemore, who's going to talk with us about National Puppy Day, pet adoption, and some recent legislation that helped shelter animals. Good morning, Holly, and happy Puppy Day.
Oh my gosh, good morning, Jennifer. Happy Puppy Day back at you.
I'm sure many of our listeners know about Best Friends. Can you just give us a quick reminder of all that you do?
Oh, sure. Best Friends Animal Society is headquartered in lovely Kanab, Utah, but we are a national organization. And our mission is to make the entire country no-kill, which to us means saving all the cats and dogs in every single American shelter. And we do that by partnering with both government shelters, private nonprofit rescues, and communities at large. And we've seen terrific progress over the last 10 years, but we're still not there yet. About 66% of U.S. shelters have reached what we call the no-kill benchmark, and we're working hard to get the rest there.
And what does that mean, the no-kill benchmark?
The no-kill benchmark is statistically 90% of all cats and dogs entering a shelter leaving alive. Why is it 90%, not 100? Because there are certain instances where euthanasia is the most merciful choice. An animal's been hit by a car, it's not savable, or it's too dangerous to safely rehabilitate. So it's a statistical benchmark that really is in service of our larger goal, which is philosophically no-kill, which is saving every savable pet that enters our shelters.
Mm-hmm. And how many animals go into shelters every year?
Oh my gosh, hundreds of thousands, millions of animals enter shelters every year across the U.S. And right now, there's still hundreds of thousands that are unnecessarily losing their lives. That number is getting less and less each year. And adoption and fostering are really two of the key components that are going to make this country no-kill.
Can I ask you one other question about no-kill shelters?
Sure.
How many are here in Utah? How many of our shelters?
Well, there's about 56 municipal animal shelters in the state of Utah that's run by government. And of those, all but two have reached that 90% benchmark. So we're very proud of the shelters and the animal rescue groups and the public who helps make that happen.
Okay, so tell me, what are the origins of Puppy Day?
The origins of Puppy Day are to celebrate the puppy in all. My dog is 7 years old, Rose, but she still considers herself a puppy. For us at Best Friends, it's an opportunity to let people know that there are plenty of puppies waiting for homes in animal shelters in Utah and beyond. So it's an opportunity to help promote adopting a wonderful puppy from your local shelter.
And what do we know from data about puppy adoption?
Puppy adoptions, you know, it's really terrific because 88% of puppies actually do get adopted within the first month of entering a shelter. So good news is that puppies are the cutest and a lot of people want to give them a good home. And most, on average, just stay in a shelter about 6 days. But even so, you know, some shelters don't have the same resources as others. And so they don't have the same marketing capability. They may not have the staffing ability to get out there and really put those puppies out on social media. And so some puppies do, sadly, linger at shelters. And about 4% of puppies entering shelters stay for more than 2 months. So that's a tragedy because you never want a puppy having to grow up in a shelter setting.
No, of course not. And are there any tips you have for people who are thinking about a puppy? Like, what are the best practices when you bring someone home?
Absolutely. I would say, yes, research. Planning for a new puppy or a new pet of any age is always great to get online. You know, what's going to be a good fit for your family? And really, where you decide to get a puppy is a very important consideration. Of course, giving puppies a loving home by adopting or even fostering in advance, it's a rewarding experience. And a lot of people will choose to foster a puppy at first just to make sure that it's a good fit for them. You know, puppies are a lot of work. And so you do, you know, want to make sure that you are up for it. And luckily, Best Friends, animal rescue groups, and many shelters have a lot of resources to help you be successful when you bring a new puppy or any pet into your home. So I would say we really, at Best Friends, encourage people to adopt rather than purchasing a puppy. Like I said before, there are plenty of cute young and baby animals in shelters. Of course, it is National Puppy Day, but we are also entering into what we call kitten season here in Utah. So we're also starting to see the kittens come into shelters. So we really do encourage people to choose that adoption option rather than purchasing from a breeder. And unfortunately, these days, it can be sometimes difficult for the public to be able to distinguish between the two. Some breeders have gotten pretty good at using adoption language basically to try to dupe the public into thinking they're adopting when they're really buying a pet online. So, you know, if you're paying hundreds or thousands of dollars to adopt a puppy, I would say that's a red flag right there.
That's interesting. And I am glad you brought up the kittens, because we may have a slight puppy bias or at KPCW. We have a lot of dogs here every day, but we do have our cat lovers, and we don't want to leave out the cat lovers.
We absolutely do not. My dog actually fosters kittens, so we're excited to bring in our new foster litter this year.
Did you say your dog fosters kittens?
Yes, she loves to. My dog is a pit bull mix. We adopted her as a puppy from a shelter in Texas, actually. But when we have a litter of orphan kittens that we foster orphan kittens at our house, and she loves to mother them and lick them, and she likes to be the surrogate mom.
That's very great. Cute. My lab would bust down the storm door to get at a cat walking across the street. So that probably would not work at our house.
It does not work for everyone. That is for sure. You do need to be careful.
What other important things should we know about the state of animals in adoption right now?
Well, we're excited here in Utah because a wonderful bill passed this last legislative session, Senate Bill 201, the Shelter Animal Euthanasia Amendments. And like I said, our shelters and rescue groups are already doing a wonderful job at saving lives in Utah. On aggregate, they are saving about 90% of all the cats and dogs entering. But there's still some that slip through the cracks. And so SB 201 provides a consistent and yet still convenient way to assure that any adoptable cat or dog at risk of euthanasia in a shelter is given the opportunity to be rescued. It's pretty simple. The shelter just needs to notify any rescue group that has come to them and said, we have interest in knowing if you have any animals at risk that we could possibly help. And so it's a wonderful way that we think is going to really help the entire state get to no-kill.
And there was a second bill that I believe addressed the situation where someone has become incarcerated and they have an animal that can't be attended, or they go into shelter facilities and can't be adopted. That was changed, was it not?
Yes, it's really wonderful. Our friends at Salt Lake County Animal Services, who have been no-kill for many, many years, and they do a wonderful job, really helped lead that bill because they see how it can impact these animals that can sometimes stay months, if not years, in a shelter setting while their cases are going through. And so, you know, this now allows judges to determine, you know, if an animal can be placed before the case is fully resolved. And so it's going to do a great deal of good for animals like Biscuit, the dog that was the mascot of House Bill 87. And it's going to allow dogs like Biscuit to not have to languish in a shelter setting anymore.
Well, that's great. Full disclosure, I am a best friend's animal rescuer, dog rescuer. Sadie's been with us for about 6 years, and she's a great dog.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you. That is exactly the kind of disclosures we love to hear.
Well, someday I'll tell you about the Christmas turkey that she ate after 5 days of being with
us.
And that was not her finest moment or mine, but we've worked it out. Well, thanks for joining us this morning and telling us all about Puppy Day. I'm sure we'll talk to you soon about the kittens.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. Have a good one.
Have a great day.